April 4th, 1958, Hollywood, California. Oscar-nominated actress Lana Turner is fighting with her boyfriend, a man with known connections to the mob. In the house, listening to this escalating argument, is Lana's daughter. When the fight is over, the boyfriend is dead, and a 14-year-old is named the killer. What happened that night in the pink bedroom of the Beverly Hills home is nothing short of a Hollywood screenplay, where only the three of them will ever know the truth. And movie star Lana Turner would need to take center stage in her most dramatic role ever, defending her daughter against a murder charge. This is Johnny Stampinato, the star, the gangster, and the knife. Hey, y'all, I'm Chris Calvert.
And I'm her husband, Rob Potter. Welcome to Hitch to Homicide.
For better or worse.
Till death do us part.
Welcome back, everybody.
Yes, welcome, welcome, welcome. And to our friends on the tiny little island of Malta.
Okay.
Merhaba, merhaba, merhaba.
You're picking all these beautiful places. I don't think I haven't noticed.
I know. I've always wanted to go to Malta.
I just want to go anywhere at this point. It's been a day. Yeah. I've lost my glasses. I'm wearing a second pair of glasses today to do the podcast. Yeah. It's just been one of those days. Yeah. Mercury's not in retrograde. And honestly, I think that like all the planets are aligning today or something, but not for me. Not for me.
We'll find them. We'll find them.
How do you lose your glasses, guys?
I don't know.
Anyway, wherever you're listening, be sure to like, rate, and review. That helps other people to find us.
It does.
You can subscribe anywhere you listen to podcasts, and you can watch us on YouTube.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm going to get started on this one right away. We're going all the way out to L.A., Hollywood.
Yay.
And as I was doing my research on this, there's a movie that Rob loves called Hail Caesar.
Oh, yeah.
And if you've never seen it, it's like old Hollywood. And while I was doing the research on this, it's exactly what I was thinking of the entire time.
Yeah. I love that era.
It's great. And
the Rat Pack. And
well, we're going to talk about one of those. We're going to talk about one of those people. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Before I get started, let me thank some sources. Medium.com, Wikipedia, Murderpedia, GeorgePalace.com, Deadline.com, the Santa Cruz Sentinel, the Sacramento Bee, Jonco.com, All That's Interesting, Eureka, Humboldt Standard, People Magazine, the LA Times, Chicago Tribune, Vanity Fair, Slate.com, CrimeLibrary.com, Chicago Magazine, and Larry King Live.
I swear that list gets longer every week.
Well, there's a lot on this one. And let me tell you, there's a little bit of a different story with each of them. You know, these older cases fascinate me.
Yeah.
But everybody's got a little bit of a different story. So, you know, I go down the rabbit hole. Yeah. I go down the rabbit hole. If you want to go there too, all of those links will be posted in the show notes.
All right. Well, you ready?
I am.
Okay, let's do this.
Lana Turner was born Julia Jean Turner on February 8, 1921 in Wallace, Idaho, which is a mining town.
Okay.
Her parents are John and Mildred Cowan Turner. Her mother is 4 days shy of her 17th birthday when she gives birth to Lana.
Wow.
And Lana would be an only child.
Okay.
Lana's parents had first met while 14-year-old Mildred, the daughter of a mining inspector, was visiting Pitcher, Oklahoma with her father, who was inspecting the local mines there. And John was 24 years old at the time, and Mildred's father objected to the courtship. And shortly after the two eloped and moved west, settling in Idaho, she was 16.
Jeez.
And then had Lana at 17.
Wow. Okay.
Lana's father was also a miner and also owned and operated a dry cleaning business in Wallace. I thought that was an interesting combo.
Yeah. It's like spaghetti and peanut butter.
Lana, or Judy, as her family called her, was always a performer. She did dance routines at her father's Elks Club, and at the age of 3, she performed an impromptu dance routine at a charity fashion show where her mother was modeling. And when Lana is 6, the whole family relocates to San Francisco, and not long after, her parents separated. Now, Lana's father supplemented his income not just by being a miner, not just by being a dry cleaner, but by gambling. And he was well known as a skillful card player.
Really?
Also read that he liked the dice a little bit.
Gotcha.
December 14th, 1930, after a successful run at the craps table, John Turner was robbed and then bludgeoned to death in San Francisco.
Oh, wow.
He made the mistake of bragging that he had this money and he was going to buy his daughter a bicycle. And he attracted the attention of some thieves. His murder has never been solved.
Oh, wow.
She had to live with family friends so her mother could work 80 hours a week as a beautician. And she's just trying to save money. And there's even a story of her living for a period of time in Modesto with a foster family who actually beat her and treated her, quote, like a servant.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. But as soon as Mildred hears about this, she immediately pulls Lana out. She hears about the abuse. She goes and gets her.
Gotcha.
In 1936, Lana's mother develops a respiratory problem, and she's told by her doctor to move to a drier climate, and these two pack up the car and move to Beverly.
Yeah.
they pack up their Depression-era old dusty car, that's what I read, and moved to Los Angeles.
Okay.
Lana's mother wanted her daughter to know how to be a lady. And so the two of them would pore over etiquette books by Emily Post, and then they would read Vogue magazine from cover to cover.
Emily Post used to be like the etiquette queen.
She still is.
Is she?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Emily Post is alive. Well, she's not alive and well.
I was going to say, she's about 247 now, isn't she?
Well, but all of her tips are absolutely alive and well.
Cool.
Lana lived a nondescript life until Billy Wilkerson discovered her at the Top Hat Cafe.
Okay.
One version of the story is that she was discovered at Schwab's Pharmacy. That is not the case.
Right.
And she'll later say that the rumor started because a columnist named Sidney Sklosky published it in several papers.
Okay.
The truth is, Lana was a junior at Hollywood High School, and she skipped a typing class to buy a Coca-Cola at the Top Hat Malt Shop on the corner of Sunset Boulevard.
That's like out of every movie.
I know. And Billy Wilkerson, the founder of The Hollywood Reporter, sees her there. He discovers her. She's 15 years old. And Mr. Wilkerson was so attracted by her beauty and her, quote, physique. That's what I read.
All right.
And he asked her if she was interested in appearing in films, to which she responded, quote, I have to ask my mother first, end quote.
Well, good for her.
I thought that was cute.
Yeah.
Wilkerson turned her over to agent Zeppo Marx, one of the Marx brothers, who was not just an actor-comedian, but also an agent.
Yeah, because there was Groucho, Harpo, and Zeppo.
Yeah. And Zeppo introduced her to film director Mervyn LeRoy, who signed her to a $50 a week contract with Warner Brothers on February 22nd, 1937.
That was a lot of money back then, especially for a kid.
It is. Yeah. That's true. It is.
Yeah.
She soon became a protege of this director, LeRoy, who suggested that she take the name Lana Turner.
Okay.
And when I heard about he was the director LeRoy, it made me think of
Mr. Lawrence.
Yeah.
In Hail Caesar.
Yes, yes.
Lawrence Lawrence.
Lawrence, Lawrence, Lawrence. Yeah. But she's with director LeRoy.
Yeah.
Lana is quickly cast in the 1937 film They Won't Forget as a sexy murder victim where her hips swayed down the street and she wore a tight sweater.
And how old was she?
17, close to 18.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
She was being objectified. It was pretty upsetting to Lana because she's still a teenager.
Yeah.
But she becomes a sex symbol overnight.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
She was the sweater girl.
Yep.
A nickname she detested. And there were all kinds of World War II guys who were going to put her on the front of their bombers,
too. B-17s were just,
yes.
Yeah. Yep.
Modern Screen journalist Nancy Squire wrote that Lana Turner, quote, made a sweater look like something Cleopatra was saving for the next visiting Caesar, end quote.
Hello.
Hello. Apparently she looked good in a sweater.
Yeah.
I've seen the pictures.
Yeah.
She's going to move from movie studio to movie studio. They were property at that time. These actors were.
Yeah.
And she did movies with Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland and Andy Hardy. And in the middle of shooting these, Lana completed her studies and graduated high school that year.
Okay.
And after that, her next movie convinced Louis B. Mayer that Lana Turner could be the next Jean Harlow.
Oh, wow.
A sex symbol who had died just 6 months before Lana arrived at MGM.
Hmm.
Now, she's going to do a ton of movies. She was even screen tested for the role of Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, but they're putting out movies right and left. Yeah. And in her lifetime, she will be in over 50 films.
Wow.
Yeah. In February 1940, Lana got instant publicity when at the age of 19, she eloped in Las Vegas with 28-year-old band leader Artie Shaw.
Really?
Her co-star in The Dancing Coed.
I can't believe I didn't know that. Artie Shaw, yeah.
Yes. Hmm. These two were married, but not for very long. And they hadn't known each other for very long either before they decided to get married.
Okay.
And this marriage is only going to last for a couple months. It's highly publicized. And again, it's highly publicized when they divorce.
Hmm.
And after she divorces him, she discovers she's pregnant.
Oh.
And she has an abortion, and the press was told that she was hospitalized for, quote, exhaustion, end quote.
Yeah.
Later, she will say that Artie treated her like an untutored blonde savage and took no pains to conceal his opinion.
Well, that's pretty much right to the point.
He was not nice. Yeah. He was not nice to her.
He was one of those terrible musicians.
Obvious. Yeah. No. Something we haven't discussed is the fact that Lana loved a party. She loved the nightlife. She liked to be seen and she liked to see others. Over her young lifetime, she would be in relationships with Tyrone Power, who she said was her one true love, Howard Hughes, Frank Sinatra,
really,
Robert Stack. She was, quote, the nightclub queen, end quote. Quote, how I'd love to dress up and go dancing with a handsome dark man. Ciro's was a favorite haunt. The head waiter would spring forward. Ah, Miss Turner, and escort me in. I had a special table right by the stairs so I could watch the comings and goings. I'd head straight there, never glancing right or left. And then when I was seated, I'd give the room a long casing, bowing to this one or blowing a kiss to that one. Silly, I guess, but fun, end quote.
It was such a special time in Hollywood.
It really was. I mean, she was a movie star and she acted like a movie star and, you know, she's turning heads.
Yeah, I mean, listen, that was the golden age.
The golden age of Hollywood.
Yeah.
In 1940, she did her first musical. The following year, she had a lead role in her second musical, Ziegfeld Girl, opposite Jimmy Stewart.
Okay.
She was also in a movie with Judy Garland and Hedy Lamarr.
Oh. Hedy Lamarr.
Hedy Lamarr.
And for In-Laws and Outlaws, if you know that movie, go ahead and post it.
Yeah. It's a good one.
Yep.
Her movies are making so much money that MGM gave her a weekly salary raise to $1,500 a week, $32,500 in today's money.
Wow.
As well as a personal makeup artist and a trailer. She got her own trailer.
Man, she's smoking now.
She is.
Living the high life.
Living in the high life.
Yeah.
Lana and Judy Garland would be lifelong friends and actually live next door to each other for a little bit in the 50s.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
She would star opposite Clark Gable in four films, and there were always these rumors that these two were having an affair, even though Clark was married to Carol Lombard, who would eventually die in a plane crash. It was all drama.
Yeah.
Drama, 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 all the time in Hollywood.
All drama, all day.
All the time. In July 1942, Lana met her second husband, actor-turned-restaurateur, Joseph Stephen, he went by Steve, Crane, at a dinner party in Los Angeles.
All right.
And after 1 week of dating, these two eloped to Las Vegas.
Lana, what are you doing?
The marriage was annulled by Lana 4 months later when she discovered that Steve's previous divorce had not been finalized before they ran off and got hitched.
Yes, that's a problem. Huh?
That's a problem.
Yeah.
And after discovering she was pregnant in November of 1942, they remarry in Tijuana, Mexico.
Hmm. I guess he was divorced by that time.
He was divorced.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Now, you can't make that up.
This whole thing, geez.
Can't make it up.
Yeah.
Lana had Rh negative blood, which causes fetal anemia and can make it really hard to carry a child. Hmm. Back then, it was a big deal. Today, it's something that's more manageable, but her doctors told her to undergo a therapeutic abortion to avoid some possible life-threatening complications. But she carries this baby to term and gives birth to a daughter, Cheryl Christina Crane, on July 25th, 1943.
Okay.
Cheryl is what is known as a star baby. She was nicknamed the baby. That's what they called her, even as a teenager. You know, she would say, "Where's the baby?" Meaning her daughter.
Sure.
But the baby is automatically turned over to a Scottish nanny whom she loved dearly. Later, Lana will say she didn't personally give her child a bath until she was a year old.
Wow.
Yeah. But Cheryl's parents don't stay together very long. This marriage was over in 1944.
Okay.
Growing up, Cheryl was only allowed to play with other star babies.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
She had a best friend who lived next door, Liza Minnelli.
Oh, really?
Liza would belt out songs on the roof of her mother's garage, and Cheryl would sit in the audience and applaud.
Wow. I got to come up with a different word than really. I've said really like 20 times now, but seriously, really?
It's because there's so many Hollywood names all just jumbled in here together.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Cheryl loved her parents, but she lived at a distance from them. And according to Cheryl, she used to slip out of bed and stare down the staircase at her mother and her famous friends. Quote, she was the perfect dream of golden beauty, unattainable, beyond reach, end quote.
Okay.
In 1946, Lana is cast opposite John Garfield in The Postman Always Rings Twice.
Oh, yeah.
This role was kind of a turning point for her because now she's more than just a pretty face and a body. She could act.
Yeah.
And she received an Oscar nomination for Best Actress. Hmm. Ultimately, Joanne Woodward would win the award that year.
Gotcha.
In 1948, she marries Henry J. Topping Jr.
Wait, what marriage is this? What number?
She's going to get married 8 times. She has going to have 7 husbands because she's already married one of them twice.
Jeez. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah.
I want to keep count.
She's got some men.
Yeah, exactly.
She does.
You don't know the players unless you've got a program.
Yep. She's got some men in her life.
Wow. Go.
In 1948, she marries Henry J. Topping Jr., a man who was a tin fortune heir and a sportsman.
Oh.
They would divorce after 4 years.
Okay.
So at this point, Lana is 27. She's been married 4 times, twice to the same man.
Jeez.
Cheryl is 5.
Okay.
And little Cheryl is kind of forced by her mom to obey whatever love interest she had at the time. So if you're thinking like mommy dearest, she was not abusive like Joan Crawford was to Christina Crawford.
No wire hangers
ever. And she actually knew Christina Crawford. They went to school at the same place. Christina's older than her. I think that's what I read.
Gotcha.
But it was kind of that feel like there were a lot of uncles coming around. And Cheryl just sort of had to go with the flow of whichever guy her mom was dating. Mm. And she's even said that like movie star Fernando Llamas would swim naked in front of her when they were alone.
My name is Fernando Llamas.
Yeah. I'm just kind of like, she's a little kid and this, you know, Hollywood star is just skinny dipping in front of her. I don't know.
Well,
kind of icky.
Yeah.
5 years later in 1953, when Cheryl is 10, her mother, Lana, marries Lex Barker in Turin, Italy.
Okay.
Lex was famous for playing Tarzan from 1949 to 1953.
Okay.
And after they're married, Lana gets pregnant with Lex Barker's child, but the baby is stillborn 7 months into the pregnancy.
Okay.
Now, this is kind of a heavy part. According to Cheryl, from the time he came into her life until the time that he left, he sexually abused her. He threatened if she told anyone.
Wow.
He said, "You will be the one that's sent away and not me."
Man.
And little Cheryl believed him.
Yeah.
And I've seen pictures of this guy. He's a nice looking guy, but just not a good person.
Disgusting.
She alleges that Lex violently raped her repeatedly throughout his marriage to her mom. Mm. And encouraged by her friends at school, Cheryl finally tells her mom, who immediately went home, walked into the bedroom where Lex was sleeping, and held a gun to his head.
Whoa.
And Lex wakes up and says, "What's going on?" And Lana said, "Get out." And he said to her, quote, "I don't know what your daughter told you, but she's lying." So Lana kicks him out. Her father wanted to murder Lex.
Yeah.
But Lana never mentioned anything about Cheryl ratting him out. He just assumed it, which meant to her it was true.
Right.
And weeks later, a frantic Lex Barker allegedly accosted Lana and Cheryl in a parking lot, grabbing Lana's steering wheel. And according to Cheryl, her mother said, quote, "I'm pulling out of here. If you don't let go, I will run you over."
Oh, wow.
End quote.
Yeah, you don't mess around with Lana.
Don't mess around with Lana Turner.
Yeah.
And with that, she hit the gas, dragging him along several feet until a grab of the brakes sent him tumbling to the asphalt. And then they sped away and he shrank into a, quote, "tiny figure dusting himself off, intently watching our flight," end quote.
Oh, they definitely like to script this thing.
Telling ya, a lot of good pros in here.
Yeah, exactly.
Lana did take Cheryl to a doctor who confirmed that it was going on. The sexual abuse had been going on between her and Lex.
That's sad.
But Cheryl's relationship with her mother was distant, and she wasn't really affectionate to her daughter. And Cheryl would want to hug her mom, and Lana would say, quote, "sweetheart, the hair, sweetheart, the lipstick."
Wow.
End quote. Yeah.
It's like an Animal House when he goes to kiss her and she goes,
"Don't mess up the lipstick."
Yeah.
Weeks after the divorce, Lana begins filming Peyton Place in 1957.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
A year later in 1958, Lana starts filming a movie for Paramount titled The Lady Takes a Flyer, and she played a female pilot.
Hmm.
Quote, "That's how the blackest period of my life began," end quote.
Really?
This is what she wrote. Quote, "It started with flowers and an innocent invitation for a drink, and it was ending with screaming headlines," end quote.
Really? Wow.
Meet John Stompanato.
Hmm.
John Stompanato Jr. is born on October 10th, 1925 in Woodstock, Illinois. His dad owned a barbershop and his mom was a seamstress. His parents were both born in Italy, but they got married in Brooklyn. So they're an immigrant Italian-American family.
Gotcha.
He was a rambunctious but not a serious troublemaker as a kid. When he's older, he's going to be 6 feet tall, 180 pounds, dark wavy hair. The girls loved him.
The olive skin.
Yes.
Italian.
Yes. Very Casanova. Much. Very much.
Yeah.
In 1943, Johnny joined the U.S. Marines. And by the spring of 44, he was in the Pacific, moving from island to island as a clerk in a service battalion.
Hmm.
Johnny participated in the capture of Okinawa.
Wow.
I'm waiting for it. Rob's a big World War II buff.
Yep.
And by the time the island had been subdued, he was making trouble. He was sneaking into the officer's mess wearing somebody else's lieutenant stripes. That's the kind of guy Johnny was.
Okay, yeah. You can't do that.
Johnny took his discharge in March of 1946 in the Far East. He claimed later on that he ran a string of nightclubs in China. Nobody really knows if this is true.
Mm-hmm.
Most think he made it up to impress people in Hollywood when he finally gets there.
Gotcha.
By another account, he was working as a civilian for the U.S. government. In any case, one day the handsome ex-Marine wandered into a dress shop and met a petite, pretty saleswoman named Sarah Yutush, who had grown up in China with her immigrant Turkish parents.
Okay.
They fell in love, and Johnny converted to Islam to marry Sarah that May.
Gotcha.
Not long after, he takes her home to Woodstock, Illinois, where he drove a bread truck and worked in an auto parts factory.
Hmm.
Sarah got pregnant, but Johnny left for California not long after the baby, John III is born.
He just up and left.
Yep.
Wow.
He's out. He's moving to Beverly now. He's done.
Yeah.
He's done. Sarah would work nights in a sewing factory. He just left him behind.
Wow.
Later, she's going to say, quote, he had a good heart. He just never grew up, yeah. End quote.
Well, she was being nice.
She was being very nice.
Jeez.
By July of 1949, Johnny Stompanato, also known as John, Jack, Handsome Harry, Johnny Stomp, John Steele, and Oscar.
Where'd Oscar come from?
Oh, I'm going to tell you. Yeah. Just hang on to your panties.
Hanging.
Hang on. He hitches his wagon to known gangster Mickey Cohen.
Ooh.
Now, there are loads of stories on how this happened. Mickey would say that Johnny hung out at his house and was kind of like a kid brother. He often served as Mickey's bodyguard, his driver. These two traveled cross-country together. Whatever their business relationship, I think it's fair to say they were close.
Okay.
Johnny's police record and FBI files say he was a lackey for Mickey Cohen, running errands, handling cash, making purchases, maybe like operating small businesses used to launder money.
He was Mickey's assistant.
He kind of was.
Yeah.
And Johnny was also sort of involved with Bugsy Siegel. Mm. He was part of that whole crew.
Okay.
Johnny carried a gun, at least occasionally, and confidential informants told the FBI that he collected protection money from spots that had jukeboxes, $1 per week.
Really?
And he picked up the proceeds from the numbers racket.
Wow.
He was arrested 6 times, usually for vagrancy. None of the charges ever stuck. Mm. By far the darkest aspect of Johnny's dealings with Mickey Cohen, one that is featured in rumor and allegations, involves sex and blackmail.
Okay.
When Johnny appeared on the scene, as the stories go, he became Cohen's magnet for aspiring actresses and established stars.
Really?
Sounds a little bit Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah, a little bit. Jeez.
Did Harvey take a page from Mickey Cohen?
Yeah.
Johnny and his target would meet, meaning a woman, mm-hmm. and the encounters often led to sex.
Okay.
And after a few trysts, Johnny would tell his victim he needed a small loan, $150 or so, and she would give it to him. And soon enough, he would ask for big money, $5,000. And they'd say, that's too much. And he'd say, quote, if I don't get this money, your husband will get the pictures.
Really? Oh, man. Wow.
So whether he's with Mickey Cohen and his cronies or on his own, Johnny gravitated to the night spots along the Sunset Strip.
Okay.
Hollywood offered Johnny a lush environment
yeah.
to flaunt his looks and charm. And according to Mickey Cohen's biography, quote, he was running around with every broad in the movie industry, end quote.
Wow.
And Cheryl Crane's biography said, quote, here it is. Oh, my gosh. I can't believe I'm going to tell you this.
Drum roll.
Quote, the gossip was that Johnny was nicknamed Oscar because the size of his penis resembled the Academy Award statuette, end quote.
Oh my God.
So there's that. Never be able to look at an Oscar statue the same way ever again.
I never want to get an Oscar.
That's not true. In 1948, Johnny married the actress Helen Gilbert, whose career was shifting from movies to television.
Okay.
She was 10 years older than he was, and the marriage lasted just 3 months.
Wow.
What is it with these people? They're married just for months. Yeah. It's crazy.
Shouldn't you, like, just date for a little bit?
Yeah, date. See if you like them first, yeah. for goodness sake. He had his eye on the stars, chasing after Ava Gardner. Mm. Johnny apparently never got much beyond sharing drinks with her, but it was enough to infuriate her other suitor at the time, Frank Sinatra.
No, don't mess with Frank.
No.
Frank was connected too, so.
Yes, and I actually read something where Frank went to Mickey Cohen and said, dude,
yeah.
back your boy off.
Exactly. Yeah.
Ava's mine. Back your boy off.
Yeah, Frank was heavily connected.
Around 1950, Johnny began surreptitiously courting the actress Janet Leigh.
Oh, wow.
Sending her flowers and records with a card signed John Steele. The two finally met and even visited together on a few occasions, but when Johnny finally revealed who he was and described his connections to the mob, Janet Leigh said, bye-bye.
Yeah. Adios, amigo.
See ya. Yeah. Don't let the door hit you in the butt on the way out.
See ya. Wouldn't want to be ya.
Yeah. In 1953, Johnny broke his pattern and married a younger woman, Helene Stanley, an actress best known for playing Davy Crockett's wife in the Disney TV show.
Oh, wow.
He lived with Helene and her parents, and get this, and raised parakeets.
Okay.
Again.
Are you making this stuff up?
Can't make it up. Oh, man. Can't make it up.
Okay.
When these two divorce in 1955, she will say that Johnny was just a user.
He was for the birds. Sorry.
She says he's a user, and I'm thinking, yeah.
You think?
Big time.
What was your first clue?
Yeah. Ugh. In the spring of 1957, Johnny wants to meet Lana Turner. She is now 37 years old. Johnny is 32.
Okay.
John first courted her the same way he approached Janet Leigh, with an outpouring of flowers and record albums accompanied by cards signed
John Steele.
He had the wavy hair and olive skin good looks of a movie star with a great body. And for some reason, he told Lana he was 5 years older than her, when in fact, it was the other way around.
Yeah.
Quote, his consuming passion was strangely exciting, but it wasn't just the sex, which was nothing special. Guess Oscar was a myth. He could be thoughtful and caring, end quote.
Well, poor Oscar.
Poor Oscar. All the Oscars. Yeah.
I guess I can go for an Oscar again.
Yeah. What a letdown. Yeah. Sorry, Oscar. It wasn't long after the relationship became public that one of Lana's close friends broke the news that John Steele was actually John Stompanato. Mm. And Lana said she had mixed feelings about dating a man who was a known gangster.
Yeah.
I bet.
You think?
To her, he was dangerous and yet appealing.
She liked the bad boys.
Quote, call it forbidden fruit or whatever, end quote. She wrote that in her book.
Wow.
Quote, this attraction was very deep. Maybe something sick within me and my dangerous captivation went far beyond lovemaking, end quote.
Hmm.
In 1957, Johnny inserted himself into Lana's life. He gave Cheryl her summer job and bought her a horse,
okay,
which Mickey Cohen later said, I paid for that horse. I bought the horse.
Oh, wow.
But he would go riding with her. And Cheryl sometimes saw Johnny more than her mother.
Hmm.
And her father, Steve Crane, didn't like it much.
Yeah.
And there are accounts that he hired a private investigator to watch Johnny when he was with his daughter, Cheryl.
No kidding.
Can't blame him. I mean, you got Fernando running around without clothes on.
Yeah.
Oscar's apparently in the bedroom and now on the back of a horse that, you know, the mobster bought.
Jeez.
Yeah. This isn't going to turn out well, but it's getting there in a very odd fashion.
Oh, what a tangled web we weave.
Very tangled.
Jeez.
Johnny's demise started as the summer of 1947 wore on and Lana began to have doubts about her man. She wanted out.
Yeah.
And she told him, I want out. And he was not letting her out.
Wow.
She flew to England to star with Sean Connery in Another Time, Another Place.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
But then she got lonely in London and silly Lana sent Johnny a ticket to come over and see her.
Lana.
Quote, our reunion was a joyful one, and for a while, John showed only his loving, docile side. Soon, he got bored, however, and insisted on coming to the studio, end quote.
Mm.
Now, their arguments built until one night he choked her so violently, she had trouble talking, and filming was disrupted.
Wow.
There's even a story, don't know if it's true, might be urban legend. I really like this, so I put it in. But Johnny showed up on the set while Lana was with Sean Connery, and he pointed a gun at them, thinking that Lana was having an affair with Sean.
Wow.
And Sean, who is ex-military, wrenched the gun out of his hand and punched him in the face.
Good for him. Yeah, I wouldn't mess with Sean Connery.
Yeah, and I'm like, dude, he's not even James Bond yet, but exactly. He's already James Bond.
So he actually thought that they were having an affair just because of the scene that they were in.
He just thought, because they were in this movie together, he thought they were having an affair. Johnny's highly jealous.
Well, it kind of makes sense. I mean, listen, when Gilligan's Island was on, people actually thought they were marooned on an island. They used to get letters. Truth.
Help Gilligan off, please. Yeah.
And yet I digress.
Is the 3-hour tour over yet?
I know.
Yeah, they're the 7 deadly sins. We're not going there. Okay. That's a lot.
All right.
The next day, and this is true, he was deported for having a firearm in England.
Right.
So, urban legend? I don't know. Mm-hmm. In my head, I want Sean Connery just to knock his lights out. When the movie wrapped, Lana left for Acapulco, planning a long rest. And her plane stopped over in Copenhagen. And to her astonishment and dismay, Johnny met her at the airport and went with her to Mexico.
Wow.
Quote, to this day, I can't tell you exactly how John knew when I was leaving England or that I was flying to Mexico via Copenhagen. He proved over and over that he had the power to do anything he wanted. End quote.
Scary.
She's a little bit afraid of him.
Yeah.
I mean, he's physically abusive to her.
Right.
And he continued to be physically abusive in Acapulco. Hmm. And one time even there, I mean, can you imagine you're on vacation? He pulls a gun on Lana when she tried to order him out of the hotel room. And usually he didn't have to use violence because she was so submissive. She was terrified. His threats were just enough.
Okay.
And while they're there in Mexico, he tells her, quote, if you're not going to be with me, you aren't going to be with anyone.
Whoa.
End quote.
Wow.
Also, while they're in Mexico and she's fighting with him, so she's having the worst vacation ever, right?
It sounds like a really great vacation.
Yeah, she's having the worst vacation ever. And Lana gets word that she's again been nominated for an Academy Award, this time for Peyton Place.
Okay.
So these two immediately fly to L.A. and they find Cheryl and Lana's mom and the entire press corps waiting at the airport in Los Angeles. And Johnny ate that up. Huh. It was just flashbulbs, flashbulbs, flashbulbs.
Sure.
And, you know, she's on his arm.
Yep.
But before Oscar night rolls around, Lana used this occasion to break it off with Johnny, saying, you're not going to the Academy Awards show with me.
I bet that went over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like a big lead balloon.
Yeah.
She was taking Cheryl and she was taking her mother.
Okay.
And then it was Oscar night, March 26, 1958. Lana, along with her daughter and her mother, were on their way to the 30th annual Academy Awards at the Pantages Theater.
It's weird to hear 30th.
I know. What is it now? Like the 99th or something?
Yeah, it's crazy.
Lana lost Best Actress that night to Joanne Woodward for Three Faces of Eve. Mm. But Cheryl was in awe of her mother that night. She's 14 years old. She danced with Sean Connery, who said, quote, Cheryl, love, he's whispering in her ear, look over there at your mom. That's what I call a star.
Oh, wow.
End quote.
Wow, wow, wow.
The Scotsman is always a gentleman. But catastrophe is brewing at 730 North Bedford Drive in Beverly Hills because Johnny is sitting at home alone with the servants, watching the ceremony on TV and growing angrier by the minute.
Jeez.
And by the time Lana returned home from her post-Oscar parties, Cheryl came home earlier, Johnny was raging. Mm. Quote, you'll never leave me home again. That's the last time, end quote.
Wow.
He berated Lana for not winning and for drinking too much. Then he got physical and began slapping her face. Then he beat her with his fists.
Jeez.
He picked her up off the ground, held her by her shoulders and looked at her and said, quote, now do you understand? You will never leave me out of something like that again. Ever.
Wow.
End quote.
What a moron.
Not a week later, on April 4th, 1948, Lana and Johnny's relationship would come to an end, and 14-year-old Cheryl Crane's life would never be the same. Cheryl was home from Happy Valley School in Ojai, Ventura County.
Okay.
It was Easter vacation. She could hear Johnny and her mother fighting. Lana wanted Johnny gone, but he wasn't having it. And the thing is, Lana warned Cheryl that she was kicking Johnny to the curb and it was going to get ugly. Okay. I mean, she just basically said, look, it's going to get bad tonight.
Yeah.
They called it the happening. That's what Lana would later call it. And the happening began on a Friday evening. Lana and Johnny are fighting. Lana would later say that she knew this fight was going to be the bad one. They were in her bedroom and Cheryl was in her room down the hall doing schoolwork. And their voices were loud enough that Cheryl could easily hear everything that was being said.
Okay.
Cheryl knew that she was ending the relationship. Cheryl knows my mom's ending this relationship.
Right.
After the Academy Awards, Cheryl had seen her mother's bruised face and knew that Johnny was beating her. And Lana told Cheryl, you can't tell anybody, including your grandmother or your father.
Okay.
And Cheryl never said she saw Johnny hit Lana, but she did see the after effects in London and after the Oscars.
Okay.
Quote, there were awful fights, screaming and yelling and smashing glasses and just, you know, things I wasn't used to hearing. And she finally sat me down and told me the whole story about having him thrown out of England when she was filming there because he beat her so badly, how he had threatened her life, my grandmother's life. She couldn't get him out of the house. She couldn't get rid of him. And my reaction was, well, Mom, call the police, end quote.
Yeah.
And of course, that is the last thing that Lana Turner wanted. She did not want the publicity.
Sure.
She felt like it would be the end of her career.
Right.
Outside the bedroom, Cheryl calls to her mother and Johnny, trying to stop the fight. She's saying, Mom, Mom. Quote, I was, you know, hoping to get them apart, end quote. Lana yells, Cheryl, get away from the door. I'm not going to tell you again. But Cheryl didn't go away. Instead, she begged her mother to stop arguing and to open the door. And she wouldn't open the door. And Lana said, go back to your room. John is leaving. But he didn't leave.
Okay.
And then Cheryl started hearing the threats. He was going to cut her face, meaning Lana's face.
Jeez.
He was going to kill Cheryl's grandmother, Lana's mom. And 14-year-old Cheryl hears, quote, and I'll get your daughter too, end quote.
And your little dog, too.
I knew it. I even put it in my notes. Rob's going to reference the Wizard of Oz. I'll get you, my pretty. As Lana and Johnny argued behind the closed door, Cheryl went down to the kitchen and grabbed a butcher knife from the drawer. Johnny and Lana had purchased the knife earlier. That's one of the stories. That they purchased this knife earlier in the day. Why you go out and buy a knife together, I don't know.
Yeah, usually you and I go to Sam's and then Taco Bell.
And they went out and bought a knife.
Yeah.
But Cheryl returns upstairs. She's got this knife and she stands outside her mother's closed door. Now the argument dies down and Johnny was going to leave the house. He went to the closet. He took a set of clothes. Some heavy wooden hangers are in his hand.
Okay.
And armed with the knife, Cheryl pleaded with her mother to open the door, which Lana did. And she stood between Cheryl and Johnny. And he was facing the door and looking at Lana with a raised arm, holding these clothes over his shoulder in such a way that all Cheryl could see was the arm and some sort of weapon. And he moved to go past Lana toward the door, his arm raised up. He's holding something. And Cheryl thrust out her arm. And from Lana's vantage point, it looked like Cheryl had punched Johnny in the stomach. And he sucked in his breath and he jerked like someone who had been hit. And he said, quote, oh, my God, Cheryl, what have you done?
Oh, wow.
End quote.
Wow.
And those were Johnny's last words.
Really? Wow.
He did a small pirouette and fell to the floor. His eyes were closed. He was wheezing. Johnny was dying on the carpet of Lana Turner's new home. Cheryl backed away, the knife falling from her hand. And this is the point that Lana realizes what's happened, that Cheryl had not punched John. She had stabbed him with the carving knife.
Man, wow.
Lana went to her daughter, who was sobbing, and helped her back to her room. Then she returned to tend to Johnny, who was dead. He was unconscious by the time he hit the floor. His breathing was labored. As if in a trance, Lana picked up the knife and dropped it into the sink, which was pink because it was a pink marbled bar. The whole bedroom, bathroom, everything's pink.
Okay.
Then she called. Who do you think she called?
I would say the police, but
she called her mother. And within minutes, a doctor and Lana's mom were on the scene. And Lana was giving Johnny mouth-to-mouth resuscitation when they arrived. That's the story. Okay. Don't know if that's true.
All right.
The doctor, a family friend, gave Johnny a shot of adrenaline directly into his heart. Don't know why, but it was fruitless.
Okay.
Johnny Stompanato, military hero, wannabe actor, small-time hood, gigolo, and abuser, was dead.
Sorry.
So who did they call next?
The police.
They called Jerry Geisler.
They were going to call the police?
Eventually. Hang on.
All right.
They called Jerry Geisler, and we've talked about him before. He represented Dolly Oesterreich when she had Otto in her attic, and Otto murdered her husband.
That's right, yeah.
And she covered it up.
Okay.
It was Jerry Geisler who did it.
Okay.
Jerry Geisler is there before the police arrive, and soon after, the Beverly Hills police descended on Lana Turner's home, and with them came the press.
Yeah, of course.
The next morning, crime scene photos of Johnny lying dead in Lana Turner's bedroom were on the front page of hundreds of newspapers.
Wow.
The police leaked it all to the press. I mean, it's crazy.
Oh, wow.
Lana and Cheryl rode to Beverly Hills Police Station in Jerry Geisler's limousine. There had been some questioning at the homicide scene, but formal statements were not taken until after Lana and Cheryl had time to strategize with Jerry Geisler.
Okay.
That opportunity to confer helped spur the rumors that it was Lana who had killed Johnny and tried to blame Cheryl.
Okay.
Now, when they're questioned by authorities, Cheryl recounts the story of Johnny's death with her mom present. And 2 days after the homicide, Los Angeles County District Attorney William B. McKesson held a press conference and made it clear the case would not receive special treatment just because Lana Turner was involved.
Okay. Wink, wink, wink.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cheryl, who had been held overnight in the Beverly Hills jail, was taken to the county juvenile hall. She's 14 years old.
Yeah.
There was still no talk of criminal charges, and Cheryl was not being held as a suspect, but as a material witness and adjudicated juvenile.
Okay.
Easter comes and goes, and on Monday morning, Cheryl is brought before a probate judge for a hearing. Geisler told the judge that he could prove that Johnny's death was justifiable homicide and asked that Cheryl be released into her grandmother's custody.
Okay.
Quote, "Let's go to trial," said Beverly Hills Police Chief William Anderson. "I am satisfied that Stompanato was killed with a knife and we have the party who did it," end quote.
Wow.
The court recommended that Cheryl not be released on bail. They were afraid that the mob or Lana Turner herself would pressure Cheryl one way or another.
Okay.
And the judge agreed and they ordered Cheryl detained. She would spend 3.5 weeks in juvenile hall.
Yeah.
I mean, she even had like a matron. I read some of the old newspaper articles where they're saying she had bacon and eggs for breakfast. And the matron said that she was eating well and getting fresh sunshine and stuff like that.
Okay.
He further ordered, against the will of the police and the DA, a coroner's inquest to determine whether a crime had indeed been committed. And in a coroner's inquest, a jury is selected by the coroner himself, and they examine the circumstances surrounding a suspicious death and render a verdict from there.
Gotcha.
A week after the homicide, the coroner convened the inquest. Jerry Geisler had managed to get Cheryl excused from testifying because of the trauma she had already been through.
Sure.
Some policemen were called to testify, but there was only one witness that mattered. Lana, the only person who saw Cheryl stab Johnny.
Right.
And never before has she needed to perform under this much pressure.
Did she get an Oscar?
She did not.
Oh, okay.
Some 20 years since she was discovered on Sunset Boulevard, Lana Turner was about to take center stage in her most dramatic and important role ever.
Well, yeah, of course.
And at stake was her daughter's life.
Yeah, wow.
So it's not an Oscar, but Cheryl.
Yeah.
April 11th, 1958, the courtroom was packed. CBS and ABC announced they were going to broadcast live. There were only 40 seats and people lined up at 6 a.m. to get into the courtroom. Jeez. The coroner explained how Johnny was stabbed once in the stomach. The knife sliced a kidney, struck a vertebrae, and twisted upward, puncturing his aorta.
A 14-year-old did this?
All with one stab by a 14-year-old girl.
Okay.
Then Lana took the stand. She wore a gray silk suit, white gloves, a hat, not a hair out of place, and she looked beautiful, even though she hadn't slept in days.
Okay.
Quietly, she explained to the court why she stayed with a man who beat her, something that she didn't understand herself.
Okay.
Jerry Geisler questioned her, had her recount a moment-by-moment recap of the argument that led up to Cheryl stabbing Johnny. When she finished, the coroner asked for a recess, and the press immediately surrounded Lana. She almost faints, but Jerry Geisler moved her out of the center of the crowd. All very dramatic.
Okay.
But it wasn't over. After Lana got off the witness stand, the police testify that they're really confused by some of the details. First, the knife was new, but it was scratched and chipped as if it had been used significantly in the past. This was supposed to be a brand new knife.
Okay.
Second, there are no fingerprints on the knife. Not Cheryl's, not Lana's, not anybody's.
Okay.
Third, there was no blood in the bedroom or on Lana Turner's clothes in the bedroom. There was no sort of disarray of any of the furniture, like there'd been a fight.
Right.
Finally, the blood on the knife contained, quote, several light and dark fibers or hairs, which could not be identified, end quote.
Really?
Yeah, no DNA. Too early.
Yeah.
And it's at this point that a mysterious man jumps up from the gallery and shouts that he needs to testify. And he's screaming, quote, lies, all lies.
What? Who's this guy?
This mother and daughter were both in love with Stompanato. Johnny was a gentleman, end quote.
What?
Yeah.
Who is who?
They haul his ass out of the courtroom.
Wow.
But he stands up. Lies. All lies.
This thing just keeps getting more bizarre.
Which is something I say all the time in the podcast. Lies. All lies.
Yeah.
But he's standing up and like shouting with his fist.
Wow.
25 minutes after the jury started deliberating, they were back to say that John Stompanato's death was
okay.
Justifiable homicide.
There you go. Okay.
And acting out of fear for her life and for her mother's life, Cheryl Crane was justified in using deadly force to stop Johnny.
And she's the strongest 14-year-old in the universe.
She is, but there are pictures. I will post pictures in the In-Laws and Outlaws. She's a tall girl.
Okay.
She doesn't look like she's 14.
Okay.
She's very beautiful. Just like her mother.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, if she's a bigger 14-year-old and she thrusts the knife in and rips it up, yeah, I can see that. Because when I'm thinking of a 14-year-old, I'm thinking of a little girl.
Well, she was a little girl, but she was tall.
That's what I'm saying. But I'm thinking, like, our daughter at 14, was she still a tiny little thing? But
yeah.
Yeah. That's my frame of reference.
Yeah. No, she was tall. She was taller than her mother.
Okay.
She was taller than her mother.
All right.
The decision was not unanimous, but it didn't have to be.
Mm-hmm.
And she was released into the custody of her grandmother because now her parents are fighting over who she should be with. Mm-hmm. It's like, you're a bad mom. Well, you're a bad dad.
Yeah.
And the judge also ordered her to see a psychiatrist with her parents.
Okay.
Yeah. Send Lana
yeah.
to see the shrink.
Just send everybody.
Yeah. Johnny Stompanato's ex-wife, Sarah, filed a $750,000 wrongful death suit against Lana, Cheryl, and Stephen Crane. It implied that Lana Turner was responsible for stabbing Johnny. The suit was eventually settled out of court in 1962. I think I read it was for $20,000. Today's money, that's $201,500.
Okay.
The conspiracy theory is still alive out there that Lana Turner stabbed Johnny and that Cheryl took the blame for her mother. And the theory persists despite Cheryl's repeated denials. She maintains that her mother would never have forced her teenage daughter to falsely take the blame.
Right.
And after spending several weeks in this juvenile hall when she's 14, she's later checked into a Connecticut mental health facility where she attempts suicide. Oh, wow. And according to her own account, after returning to Los Angeles a few months after she turns 18, she began abusing alcohol and prescription pills and attempted suicide once more. Mm. She reportedly found new hope, however, when she went to work as a hostess in her father's restaurant. Oh. And in 1968, met her future wife, model Jocelyn LeRoy, which I thought was funny. The last name is LeRoy, just like the director's name.
Yeah, yeah. Lawrence Lorenz.
Lawrence Lorenz. Now, there is a book by a man named Eric Root who claimed that as a platonic friend of Lana's, she confided in him a great deal. He was a hairdresser to the stars.
Okay.
And Eric reported that one evening he and Lana were in a suite in the Plaza Hotel, as you might be, watching a television show about Hollywood scandals, as you might be.
Okay.
Everybody's into true crime.
Yeah.
And suddenly he said in his book that images of Lana, Johnny, and Cheryl are flashed on the screen. And Eric wanted to like jump up and turn off the television set, but Lana stopped him. And when the show moved on to another scandal, he said that Lana said to him, quote, "I killed the son of a bitch and I'd do it again," end quote.
Really?
That's what Eric says.
Wow.
She told Eric how much she was suffering because of the situation. And when he asked her why, she mentioned her daughter, Cheryl. Quote, "Cheryl, I owe her so much. I've done so many things wrong in my life, but if I die before my daughter, you should tell the truth so I can rest in peace," end quote.
Wow.
Now, who knows if that's true
or not. Yeah. Was he looking for attention?
He was. Yeah, wrote a book.
Of course, yeah.
Eric explains in the book that in the following years, he pieced together himself the truth. Johnny's body was officially found on the floor by the bedroom door, but Eric deduced from his conversations with Lana that he had, that Johnny had actually been stabbed in her bed.
Okay.
The official version had been that Cheryl had stabbed him with a knife that she took from the kitchen, but Lana told him that the murder weapon was a knife she kept in her nightstand drawer because of Johnny's physical abuse and because she was afraid of him.
Wow.
And in the weeks before his murder, there had been so many arguments and fights. That's why she put it there.
Gotcha.
Eric claims that the first people to arrive at the murder scene were Lana's attorney, Jerry Geisler, and a guy named Freddie Otash, a famous Hollywood private eye. They found the body and a hysterical Lana. And in a strange twist in the tale, here it is, Cheryl's father had employed the private eye to spy on Johnny when he was teaching Cheryl to ride. And Otash reported that Johnny's intentions toward the 14-year-old were less than honorable. Mm. He further claimed that Lana had discovered Cheryl and Johnny in bed and that this had provoked her to murder her lover and the plunderer of her daughter.
Yeah.
He then went on to say that he had personally wiped Lana Turner's fingerprints from the murderous weapon and added Cheryl's, but the police said there were no fingerprints. Mm. So, I don't know.
Yeah.
Lana Turner went on to make more movies. She went on to marry again. She would be married 8 times,
jeez,
7 men, one of them twice, of course, Stephen Crane. In her final year, she starred on the TV show Falcon Crest from 1982 to 1983. I did not know that.
I didn't either.
Lana Turner died in 1995. She did write a book. I will post a link in the show notes. Don't know if you can still buy it. I think it's out of print. It might be on Audible.
Okay.
Cheryl Crane has a book of her own, and I will link to that in the show notes as well. She says John Root's story is all hogwash. Not true in any way.
Right.
That she actually killed Johnny and that it was justifiable homicide.
Hmm.
And, you know, she even said after her mother passed away, why would I stick to the story?
Yeah.
Everybody's dead. Why would I stick to the story? But that is the truth.
Yeah.
Cheryl is 79 years old and lives in Los Angeles. She also writes fiction.
Hmm.
Now, Deadline, a Hollywood website, has stated just this past March that the Lana Turner book, A Murder in Hollywood by Casey Sherman, is in the works as a series from Jake Crane.
Okay.
It's So we might see it again on Netflix or Hulu or who knows. All right. But that is the story of Cheryl Crane, 14-year-old who defended her mother, Lana Turner. And that's all I have to say about that. Hey, Hitch to Homicide listeners. Have you read any good books lately? Or have you listened to any good books? All of the Sex and Lies series books, as well as the Jane Doe series, are available on Audible and iTunes. Hotter Than Hell and Half of Alabama, the Sex and Lies series begins with Sex, Lies, and Sweet Tea. There are 9 books to listen to in that series alone. Left as a newborn to die in a dumpster, she has no name. Tossed from foster home to foster home, she has no family. With no known past, she's deemed a perfect fit for a task force Washington denies exists. A selective assassin for the United States government, Jane Doe tracks down known terrorists on domestic soil. The Jane Doe books have been called a bit military, a bit assassin, and a bit genius. Start the new year by listening to a good book by me, Chris Calvert, on Audible or iTunes. Or if you'd like to read, go to chriscalvert.com and download some free books. And thanks for being a listener of Hitch to Homicide.
Well, this whole thing, I mean, literally is a Hollywood script.
It is.
It's crazy. Oh, my gosh. From being discovered at 15 years old by getting a soda to,
yep,
to the murder trial. I mean, gee.
What? All the famous people that she was around and with. And yeah. It's crazy. Yeah. It really is, but also very true. And you couldn't have even scripted it any more that her bedroom was all pink.
Yeah. Yeah.
The bathroom was all pink. She had pink marble. Yeah. She put the knife in a pink marble sink. I mean,
I want to know who the set designer was.
Yeah. I think it was exactly like that.
Yeah. Well, we'll never know, I guess.
We won't.
For sure. But the one thing that I do know about are really dumb criminals.
Bedazzle me.
Okay, well, let's do a little, well, bless your heart.
Well, bless your heart.
All right, well, I'm going to start off with this one, and I'm calling it Details Schmetails.
Okay. Yeah.
Though he pleaded innocent, LaDonald Montgomery of Houston, Texas, was slapped with a life sentence for armed robbery.
Okay.
But shortly after the trial, his lawyer dug up evidence that would exonerate the man, something Montgomery knew but had completely forgotten.
Okay.
What do you think that was?
That he wasn't there.
Well, he happened to be locked up in jail at the time of the robbery.
I got it right.
ding, ding, ding. He forgot to mention that.
It couldn't have been me. I wasn't there.
Oh, my gosh. All right. All right. Number two. And this is a little Yogi Berra quote here. Deja vu all over again.
It's deja vu all over again. That's a great quote.
It is. A couple of disoriented robbers from Edmonton, Canada didn't choose wisely.
Okay.
Yeah, the two raided a gas station in Vancouver in September of 1981. They tied the gas station attendant and fled with the loot in a car.
Okay.
Now, on the run, they got lost and decided to ask for directions at a gas station. What they didn't notice was it was the same gas station that they had just robbed. In the meantime, the attendant had called the police and the two were arrested. Oops.
You want to know what this reminds me of? When Rob and I were on our honeymoon, GPS was kind of like a new thing. Yeah. And we took it with us, paid the package for Europe. We're in Italy. Yeah. We've got the GPS up there and we're just, it looked like spaghetti. Yeah. And we just kept getting on the wrong road. Yeah. It took us forever.
Yeah, the highways in Italy aren't, they're not very friendly.
Yeah, it was pretty funny though. It's like, oh my gosh, which one? Yeah. But it was literally spaghetti.
Oh, well. All right, number three. Wait, this isn't my car. He's not one of the most smarter ones, is how it was explained by U.S. Marshal after his arrest. A Louisiana man back in 2012 made an attempt to steal a car containing a state police detective and 2 members of the U.S. Marshal's fugitive task force. All right.
How unlucky can you get?
Yeah. He just came to the door of a stopped car at a signal and insisted on opening the door. Soon he realized the detective sign on the car and the 2 marshals of the fugitive force sitting inside the car.
These are armed men.
Yeah, he tried to run, but was caught a short chase after that. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, God love him. No, bless his heart. Yeah, sorry, yeah. Bless his heart.
All right, number four, last but not least, I was okay. just trying to help. A 37-year-old man called Stuttgart demanded a ransom of 100,000 euros from a car dealer.
Okay.
Yeah, he threatened consequences if not to get paid.
Okay.
The extorted company summed up the letter first as a bad joke because the crook left his bank account and his telephone number on the ransom note for any questions.
Well, how else are they going to know how to find him?
I was just trying to help, yeah. Based on the phone number, turned out that Stuttgart was a former customer of the dealership. The police arrested him immediately.
No, bless his heart. Yes,
bless his heart.
Well, if you have a bless your heart or you know someone's heart who needs blessing yep. or somebody who's trying to carjack the marshals.
Exactly. Jeez.
You can go to hitchtohomicide.com. There's a pull down menu. Yep. You can also suggest a case. Yep. That's my amazing husband out there.
That's my beautiful bride in the booth.
Join us next time on Hitch to Homicide.
Bye, y'all.